The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Another night of wow at the Euros. Italy through against Belgium. Champagne football and Martinez on the rocks in the big match in Munich. Meantime, in St. Petersburg, Spain meet Switzerland and pull off the worst game involving Busquets since my school days, taken to penalties by the Swiss, but scraping through. We look back at that and forward to Sunday's other quarters, Denmark against the Czech Republic and, yes, England-Ukraine. Plus, there's hot takes on the day's news from around the world of football. It's totally at the Euros in association with Paddy Power.
L'Italia con orgoglio torna a cantare l'inno a Wembley. Torniamo a cantare l'inno a Wembley.
Woof, yes, that's right. They will be back singing the hymn at Wembley. Our friends the Italians. It's Saturday the 3rd of July. And here we have a big fat totally at the Euros for you. We've got, oh, Charlie Eccleshare with us. Congratulations, Charlie. New father, Charlie.
Yeah, not actually that new, but yeah, I'll take it all the same.
Okay. Also with us, Oily Sailor himself, Duncan Alexander. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Hello to you. And also James Horncastle. Hello, James.
Hello.
Well, quite. Later on, there'll be a bit of Alvaro on Spain. We've had two games, of course, this Friday. Spain taken to penalties by Switzerland. A rough night for that Swiss fellow with the Harry Potter glasses, really, after his team's performance from the spot, and the Spanish just creeping through, no goals in open play in that game for Luis Enrique's side. But they will be facing Italy in the semi-final at Wembley after the Italians defeated the Belgians, the number one ranked side in the world, 2-1 this evening. Well, actually, last night for you, listener, in Munich. Crikey, anyway. All sorts of drama. Later on, as I mentioned, we're going to be looking forward to, of course, Saturday evening's games. And some of the other stuff that's happening beyond the world of the Euros. But hey, we're going to begin with Belgium, Italy in Munich.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Centrale c'è Immobile, ancora Insigne, rientra su Tielemans che lo perde. C'è la possibilità del destro! Lorenzo! Insigne! Eccolo il gol! Eccolo la mattonella! Eccolo il tiro a giro! Eccolo il suo gol!
All right, steady on, mate. Yeah, that was, of course, the Insigne scoring the goal. He's been trying to put away all the tournament, and very nice it was too. That was 2-0. Before that, Bonucci thought he'd given Italy the lead. It was called back for offside. Barella went barreling through, actually, the Belgian box and opened up the scoring. And then we had Lorenzo, the Il Magnifico, with that one. And then never a pen, but the Belgians got back into it after Doku went down. And, James Horncastle, let's start with you. That's what, 32 games without defeat and the most impressive of the lot?
Perhaps, yeah. It's certainly been a knock on, no matter how well they played, that they haven't played someone quote-unquote good or big, even though if you look at their group stage games, even the warm-up games prior to it, they now look even better with hindsight. I mean, they flattened the Czechs, who put out the Dutch. They flattened the Swiss, who put out the French and took the Spanish to penalties. And tonight they put out the number one ranked team in the world. And I think it was there was everything in that performance. It was another reminder that, you know, after the round of 16 game against Austria, which Mancini had kind of said, look, this will be the harder game because it's the one where we have everything to lose. Austria, the underdogs in that game, and we can go out if we suffer defeat in that. And you could see in the second half when they began that badly at Wembley, they began to panic. Tonight, I think they went into it believing that it was an evenly matched game, that there wasn't as much pressure on them. But I think, you know, as I was saying, in that first half where they played the football that we've seen from them so far, the second half was different. The second half, it had everything. It had, you know, heartbreaking Spinazzola, who's been one of the players of the tournament, going off. What does that mean for Italy? Mm. What did it mean for this game? You had Chiellini with that kind of very reminiscent of Cannavaro in Dortmund against Germany, where just everything that Belgium threw at Italy seemed to hit him and bounce off him. And yeah, great saves from Donnarumma as well. And yeah, wonderful shithousery and play acting as well, which it was just fantastic to see. So I thought you got to see the perfect balance of the new Italy and the old Italy in this game.
I thought that's the best played injury time I've ever seen in a football game, I think. I think it was 5 minutes initially. I think the first four, the ball wasn't in play, and then the ref was like, I'll add on another one and a bit. And it was just perfectly done. Even Donnarumma celebrating a goal kick with the fans right at the end was perfect. But it, like you say, James, it was a game of two halves. The first half was like end-to-end, some of the best international football I've seen for a long time. But it also, there's a lot of people online sort of going, well, why don't all teams play like this? It's brilliant, this pace, and you know. And then the second half was a series of muscle injuries as the impact of that first half hit home. And yeah, I think Spinazzola is going to be a huge loss. It really impacts the way Italy played. But the togetherness and the sort of team spirit, I think, was so clear. And you know, I think that game against Spain, obviously there's a lot of history between the two countries, and I think you could see Italy worrying about that match, but on paper they should definitely win.
Well, they've definitely looked like the side, haven't they, with kind of the most coherent plan. You know, we've seen so many of the big teams looking a little bit lost, and I was talking about this with a friend, and he was basically making the point that a lot of it must be down to the fact they've got a manager as good as Mancini. I think it's really interesting now. You look, the standard of management at international level is way down on what we're used to at club level, plus the fact they get so much less time with the players, which is probably why elite managers don't really want to be managing international level. But he still seems to have it. And it did get me thinking, like, he hasn't been back to the Premier League since winning the title, which is a really rare thing, actually. And I don't know how much that's to do with the perception of him and his personality. You know, he's clearly not the easiest to get on with, but he appears to be making an enormous difference for them. They just look so complete, and you know, they have those automatisms that you see at club level that allows teams to attack in a really exciting, entertaining way because the players know exactly what they're doing. So, I mean, on the basis of what we've seen today, you would think they would be the big favourites against Spain. But who knows? I mean, maybe Spain will turn it on for that game in a way they were unable to today.
Possibly so. From Belgium's point of view, I doubt your words are going to be quite so glowing about Roberto Martinez, but they did have some huge opportunities. A couple of moments in the second half when it just seemed inevitable that the ball was going to find the net for them, and yet somehow Italy survived. How close do you think that this game actually was?
Well, I tweeted actually at halftime. I thought I had a weird feeling Belgium would win the game 3-2, which obviously didn't come to pass. But I don't think it was a million miles away. I mean, I think if that Lukaku one goes in and they've got the momentum at 2-2, like, you know, it's a cliche, but these are small margins. I don't think they're anything like as coherent a team as Italy. You mentioned Martinez. I think he's quite a good example of the kind of level of manager you have in these tournaments. But we've seen Belgium come back and win a knockout game at major tournament under him from 2-0 down, as they did against Japan at the last World Cup. So I think had that gone in, they may have just rode that momentum. They've got attacking players good enough to do it, but I don't think they necessarily deserve to do that on the balance of the first half and the game as a whole.
I mean, it, obviously one of Mancini's final games as City manager was the cup final that he lost against Wigan with Martinez in charge of Wigan, you know. And it also, like Charlie said, then it feels a little bit like that in this game, almost like Martinez set up as the smaller team to try and contain Mancini. And it didn't really work. I mean, it became apparent in the second half that they just realised that their best threat or best way of scoring was probably just to keep feeding the ball to Jeremy Doku, who obviously came in as a teenager into this game, and he had a really good match. And I think for a lot of people who don't watch a lot of Ligue 1 hadn't really seen how good he is. And he's definitely going to come out of this tournament with a lot of credit, and I imagine his agent will be quite busy over the next few days. But it seemed as the game went on, Belgium never, although they did have a couple of good chances, they never really built up that head of steam. They looked a little bit more coherent in the first half, I think. De Bruyne, I think Italy played De Bruyne pretty well. He dropped a bit deeper in the second half and didn't look completely fit to me. He looked increasingly very hot during the game. I don't know how warm it was in Munich. But and in the end, Belgium's last shot was in the 84th minute. And as we know, and as we mentioned, the gamesmanship was superb from Italy, and they didn't really test Donnarumma at all towards the end.
Right, best Doku performance since the planet Geonosis. I felt myself, James. What happened?
I was trying to think of a joke earlier around that, but I couldn't. Yeah, well done.
I wasn't joking, but so no Spinazzola against Spain. But what's the next step for this Mancini masterpiece? And just if you can briefly, it's a very excellent point that Charlie makes. Managers don't have a lot of time, and the sea change that Italy have undergone under Mancini is quite extraordinary. To see them leaving a couple of players back while they pressed Belgium up the field, it's just such a switch in mentality from them. How has he been able to affect that so easily or so rapidly?
Well, I think it's not all him is the answer to that. I think this is work that the Italian Football Federation has been bringing forward for the last 10 years. And the reforms that Arrigo Sacchi kind of set in motion when Italy went out in the group stage of the 2010 World Cup and basically completely overhauled young players, at least when they came in to play for the national team at Coverciano. And these players, I mean, you talk to Barella, Locatelli, players of that generation, they've been playing together for Italy in this style since the under-15s. And I think one of the things Mancini's been very good at is to base this team around the quality at his disposal rather than impose his system, his ideas on it, which is what his predecessors did. It's what Conte did to good effect with his 3-5-2, his classic Conte system. It's what Giampiero Ventura, his terrible successor, also did with less success. And instead, Mancini has said, right, I haven't got one system here. I just want to base it around the skill that we've got and play with the same values that these players have been brought up with when they've been playing for the national team at youth level. And I think that's why this team looks so coherent. It looks like they know each other inside out, that they've played together. I think the other thing to say is that, it's quite unusual. Only two players who start from Juventus, Chiellini and Bonucci. Chiesa started tonight, but he's only started two games this tournament. The rest are players who, play for Sassuolo or in, Insigne, Verratti and Immobile's case, played together for Pescara. So there are guys who have played together at club level, but not at sort of big clubs that have rivalries. Although, man, Ciro Immobile tonight had one of the worst performances by a centre forward I can remember. It was unbelievable. Mancini left him on for 75 minutes. It was just incredible, and they still won. I mean, that's another thing that makes you think, wow, okay, this is if Italy, I don't know, had a centre forward as talented as Verratti as a midfielder or as Insigne as a winger, that game would have been out of sight, I think, at halftime.
International football's increasingly it's becoming apparent that it's either, teams are either hit rock bottom and they have to go back to their football association and basically rebuild the values of that country's football philosophy, or 10 years on, that's come to fruition and everything's going well, or 4 or 6 years after that, the team have done so well that everyone just, you know, it's all infighting and everyone hates each other. So, and it's just repeat, but everyone's on a slightly different point on that cycle. So, you know, Italy and England possibly are on that, on the up at the moment, whereas other teams have peaked and are on the way down.
Crikey, you're a bit jaded, aren't you, Duncan? Charlie?
No, I just wondered something, like...
I thought that was quite upbeat.
question for James. I mean, why do you think Mancini, given he won the FA Cup and won, you know, ended City's top flight title drought, why do you think he hasn't been back to the Premier League in 8 years? I mean, how much is that him? How much is that clubs not wanting him?
Well, I think James will remember this as well. At Inter, when he won the title 3 years in a row, the first one was kind of handed to them after the Calciopoli scandal, but and then Juventus were relegated, other teams had points deductions, some of them lost their best players to some of the Spanish giants, but again, mainly Juventus. People kind of looked at Mancini and thought, wow, you're at Inter, spent loads of money, you're taking advantage of a league where your competitors have been weakened, and then Mourinho comes in, wins the treble. And then likewise at Man City, a lot of people looked at it and thought, wow, he's at the club that's got more money than anyone in the world. They've spent that money and great, you know, he's won the league title for the first time in 40 years. But for Mancini to be successful, he needs to have money in the same way that people look at Conte and think exactly that now. Okay, if we hire this guy, then this is what we're going to have to spend. And then he kind of drifted. I mean, you know, he went to, I think he wanted to get back in. And sometimes when you want to get back in, you make the wrong decisions. I mean, he went to Galatasaray. He then went back to Inter. There was a change of owner who wanted their own guy, who wanted to recruit in a different way. So they clashed. He left. He then went to Zenit. All of a sudden, you know, he was coaching big clubs, but in leagues that are outside the top five. And I think at that stage, you risk becoming forgotten about. Even though I think in hindsight, he has been able to introduce the same winning mentality that he had as a player, you know, when he won Samp their one and only league title, when he won Lazio their first league title since the 70s. You know, you saw him do that at Inter, first time in 18 years they'd won the league, first time 40 years that they'd won it at City. Yeah, that is who he is. I mean, you know, James will know, having interviewed him and being around him, he's you know, on the one hand, he's like a very handsome guy, but he can be quite, he's got that edge about him, which you can kind of see why he wins. But it's easy that he's been forgotten about.
Quite a reminder this evening in Munich, last night for you, listener. What do you think then? What do you think about the clash with Spain, James? But before we let you go to kind of bang out a top piece for The Athletic about this game.
I don't think there's any stopping Italy right now. I think they played the best football in the tournament. I think they've been that good. And Spain in these last two games, okay, you know, in their final group game, in the Croatia game, they've what, scored 10 goals. But at the same time, they look like a team that might never score. It's a very weird dynamic that they've got. There was phases of the game last night where they reminded me a little bit like of Germany in against England, where, you know, the defense and the midfield is okay, and then you're like, oh, they've got to get to the final third. Who's up front for them? And Spain sometimes give you that same impression. So I don't think Italy have got anything to fear. I know that they feel that they're playing with house money now, because they, you know, I think they're privately, they thought that a semi-final was a realistic goal, but they were kind of publicly saying a quarter-final would be great. Already exceeded expectation. And yeah, I think the press is off in many respects. And certainly, I think even if they were to go out, you know, Mancini will go out of this tournament head held high, believing that they've got something to build on going into the World Cup. Whereas I think with Luis Enrique, there just seems to be a lot of polemic. There seems to be a lot of, you know, arguments about team selection. Is this team any good? So, yeah, we'll see. I think I'm confident.
All right. Well, last time the two teams met, at the sharp end of a Euros tournament, of course, it was Spain who ran out 4-0 winners. That was in the final in 2012. But so much has changed. So very much has changed since then. James, have a splendid evening. And we look forward to speaking to you again soon, ahead of that semi-final, perhaps. And we'll be back after this, listener, talking about Spain-Switzerland.
The Euros are here, and we'd better make the most of them because they only come around every 4-5 years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpadium. If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch. And if one leg of your 4+-fold bet builder lets you down, get money back as a free bet on all games this Euros. Paddy Power. Pretty much only max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds and odds 1 to 5 on exclusive T's and C's apply. 18+. BetGambleAware.org.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
After Ruben Vargas and schießt jetzt und verschießt übers Goal in.
Yeah, a little bit of Swiss commentary then on Ruben Vargas and the miss pen that basically saw Spain go through in the shootout. The Swiss had been banking on penalties through extra time, but failed to account for their own poor finishing. The game had taken its customary start, Spain benefiting from an own goal for the third time. Zakaria with the deflection off Jordi Alba's shot. Switzerland, though, bouncing back once again with Jordan Shaqiri. Just after that, they went down to 10 men and then had to kind of hang on through the extra 30 minutes until the spot kicks. Spain goes through then without having scored from open play and having barely mustered many shots on target in the course of the 120 minutes. Joining us now on the line is Alvaro Romeo. Alvaro!
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you? How nervous was that evening's work for you?
I think that in the last 4 days, I lost 4 or 5 kilos and I aged 7 or 8 years because Spain played a crazy extra time against Croatia, and same thing happened against Switzerland. And this time, it was down to Spain to win it, really, after Switzerland lost one man, Freuler, on the 77th minute. But they just couldn't score in the extra time. And then an unusual suspect, Unai Simón, became the hero of Spain, stopping two penalties, saving two penalties.
Mm. Okay, so is there a serious problem with Luis Enrique's side then?
I think that as a team, they are doing everything they can, and I would say that very well. But then individual executions are costing Spain a lot. We saw that in the game against Croatia when Unai Simón made that massive mistake, just letting Pedri score an own goal, even though we know that it was the goalkeeper's mistake. And for example, today, the goal that Switzerland scored, it was a mistake, a lack of understanding maybe between Laporta and Pau Torres, also a bad reaction by the Villarreal defender. And I think that overall in the tournament, Spain is paying because of that. Bad executions are costing a team that collectively they are doing many things well. You just have to go to the stats pack of UEFA to see that Spain is one of the teams that are doing more attacking sequences, that they are conceding less shots. But then again, some players are having a misfortune. They are making mistakes in pretty much every game. And the team has to make a monumental effort to recover from that and to be in the game. And yeah, fortunately today for Spain, Freuler was sent off. And then after that, well, yes, playing against 10 men, they managed to create some chances. But against Italy, any poor execution, any big mistake, not scoring or anything like that, is going to cost Spain, definitely, because Italy is a far better team than Croatia and definitely better than Switzerland too.
Okay, it's the second game in a row you've gone to extra time. Not sure how much that's going to impact on the team's legs. But from what you're saying then, you still believe that this Spain side could be just kind of one good performance away from finally clicking?
I think they could, yes, because this is a team that in the Nations League back in autumn, they managed to qualify for the Final Four, which tells you that against opposition their level, they have managed to maximize what they do. The good thing with Spain is that they've got vitality. The players that come onto the pitch, they are ready and they don't seem to be aloof and they all make a contribution. I think that they are fresh because Luis Enrique has rotated the team a lot. And I believe that Spain has a conviction in the style because they've got a manager who has persuaded the players that they have to play this way. And there is unity in the group. This time, Spain is not fractioned. There are no, you know, different groups within the team, Real Madrid players, Barcelona players. This is a good unit. So I think that this is the, or these are the reasons to believe in Spain. But when you see Italy play, you realize that Italy, they've got something else. They've got an extra point of quality, maybe, or definitely an extra point of conversion. In the boxes, they are much better than Spain, and there are not, or they don't do so many individual mistakes.
Mm. Charlie and Duncan, what did you make of Spain against Switzerland? I thought they were a bit rubs.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I feel like this team, this Spanish team... Maybe in the age of data, etc., this isn't so fashionable to say something so unquantifiable, but I feel like they lack a bit of personality. They seem to do kind of all the right things in lots of ways. They have nice patterns. Even like the way they were taking shots, they were all well struck and on target, but they were all straight at the keeper. And just feel like they lack a bit of edge. Disclaimer on this, I also said the same thing about Man City at the start of last season, that they kind of lack personality and played in this way. And we saw how that turned out. But yeah, that was my assessment. It used to irritate me when people said about the team that won all those titles in 2008, 10, 12, that they were boring. I didn't see that. I really enjoyed watching them because... it always felt like they were going to score and that they had control. Whereas I do find this team quite uninspiring, just because I do feel they lack that edge and that threat. And I know that might sound strange given that they scored 5 in each of their last 2 games, but they've also just missed so many chances. And I just felt today it was telling because after they scored that early goal, you never really got a sense they were going to just take the game and really pin Switzerland back and put it out of sight. I felt from... when they didn't score a second, that there was, it felt almost inevitable they were going to concede. I mean, it looked like it was going to be from a set piece, but you know, it was absolutely no surprise that they did. And given all the advantages they had in the game with the red card, the injuries that Switzerland suffered, it to me was a very, very unconvincing, unconvincing result and performance.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Charlie. I mean, Sommer made 9 saves in that game, but like you say, none of them. They were good saves, but none of them were like, wow, he's really stopped Spain from, you know, a brilliant chance there.
And they were
and the
pretty
game
good,
did pivot.
Though.
Yeah, they were. So he played really well. He's made 15 saves in the knockout stage, which is the most by any keeper in any knockout stage in Euros history. So he'll go down as, probably he'll be the goalkeeper of the tournament, I would say. But even so, people buy narrative too much now. Everyone was going, oh, well, Spain will definitely lose the penalty shootout because Jan Sommer can't let in a penalty, because that's what narrative says, which isn't the case. But we can't really underestimate how much the red card changed the match, because the equaliser from Jerdan Shaqiri was Switzerland's last shot of the game, which sounds bad, but when right. you actually look at what they had to do, it, you know, that was the reason why. And I think, I just felt sorry for Switzerland. They, you know, they obviously took part in such a epic game on Monday, and this one was similarly epic. They just didn't quite come out on the right side.
Didn't you, both games on Friday featured pretty outstanding performances by keepers, and this debate of which one's better, if you could put the two of them together, you know, what would you have between Donnarumma and Sommer? And the answer is, of course, Donna Sommer. Alvaro.
I wanted to say that Switzerland was fantastic, and that shouldn't be forgotten. This is a team that know how to nullify you. I think that the defenders were fantastic, Sommer as well. So I don't want to take anything away from them. And as for Spain, I would say that, yes, I agree that they haven't been very inspiring so far, but at the same time, they've they've got plenty of players who could be very close to making a decisive step in their career and becoming very good. Because as it stands, I think Spain has many players who are, let's put it this way, Europa League level, all right? But they've got the feeling that in 1 or 2 years, if they got the right management, the right coaching, they could become very good as well. And Pedri is probably the best possible example of that. Well, I think that Pedri is already Champions League level, by the way.
Right.
But I believe that these players, they could be part of the start of something. One never knows when a great team is born, but I do believe that having won 2 extra times in this fashion against Croatia and against Switzerland, if anything, fortifies the idea of the Spanish national team. And I know that they've got many, still they do many errors, but I think that this is something that moving ahead and with a bit of maturity, this is going to be polished for good.
Yeah, I think that's probably a big part of it. I think that's a really good point, that it may be that these are players and this is a team that we'll really see come to the fore of the tournaments to come. But that might be slightly the issue from a kind of less informed English audience, is that we're so used with Spanish teams to seeing these kind of legendary players that we're so familiar with. And I think that makes it easier to get behind them when it's Xavi and Iniesta and guys like this, whereas we're almost being introduced to some of these players for the first time. You know, those people who don't watch so much, you know, Europa League and La Liga and that sort of thing. And maybe that just makes it a little, feel a little bit more anonymous and less characterful. I also just, something I've noticed, and Duncan, you may actually know this, but it occurred to me, and I don't know why this is, but a team never seems to win their second shootout in a major tournament. They always seem to lose it. Like Euro 96, both England and France lost. In the last World Cup, in the 2014 World Cup, Holland won one and then they lost one.
Yeah.
I think the numbers bear me out on that. And it seems counterintuitive because you might think, oh, they're well practiced at it, but it seems to always go the other way.
Well, you're right. And this was Switzerland, the fourth team to go to penalties twice in a single Euros. And yeah, England and France won one and the last one in 96. And then Poland did the same in 2016 as well. And I think probably what it is, if you think back to England, they in 96, they picked exactly the same takers in exactly the same order, which actually worked. But then it obviously went round to you know, sudden death. But I think often what happens is, you know, the penalty shootout the other night against France was technically brilliant, and then Switzerland were not technically brilliant, and well, neither was Spain, to be fair. But I mean, I guess obviously Switzerland are famous for being one of the only teams to ever have a penalty shootout and not score in it when they lost to Ukraine on penalties in 2006. They didn't concede a goal in the tournament and didn't score in a penalty shootout and went out. So they might be feeling a bit sad tonight, but it's not as bad as 2006.
Alvaro, in Spain, are people getting behind this team, or is there similar kind of levels of mistrust?
No, little by little, I think that people are getting behind the team. You know, from the beginning, there was a sector of the Spanish fan base that weren't lucky with Luis Enrique for not having picked on players from Real Madrid. But yes, obviously, it's inevitable. I mean, as the games went by, Spain started being slightly more entertaining. They kept on winning. And yeah, I think that nowadays, pretty much everyone is behind the team, and especially if they play against Italy, I expect a huge audience watching the game on TV next Monday.
Charlie, a word on the Swiss.
Well, yeah, this was actually about a player who wasn't playing today but got a lot of airtime, partly because of how well he played against France, and you know, he's known to an English audience, is Granit Xhaka. And I've just found it funny the commentators, the way they've been talking about him is as if he's this kind of competition winner, and isn't it amazing that he can sort of kick a football when he has actually he's come off the back of actually a pretty good, consistent season. So yeah, I think it's funny the kind of how entrenched that view is of him. He was obviously brilliant against France, and I think that's another thing Spain benefited from. I mean, he's their captain and has been really important for them.
One might even say, Charlie, that Xhaka was required, you know, for the Swiss this evening.
They also lost Breel Embolo in the first half as well, which was another blow. And we did get to enjoy an English refereeing team produce a controversial red card. The first red by an English ref in a tournament, I think, since Howard Webb sent off John Heitinger in the 2010 World Cup. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Was the one before that, was that the Graham Pohl double, triple yellow card, I wonder?
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Yeah, it probably was.
back in 2006.
Three yellows, one dream. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So there was that Euro 2008 controversy, wasn't there, with an offside in a Poland game. So we've really made our mark on the international stage.
Nice. And of course, Howard Webb not sending off De Jong. Don't forget that. Anyway, the Swiss are on their way, and many thanks to them for lighting up various bits of this tournament, especially that clash with France. Spain, Italy on Monday. Next up for us, though, we're going to have a look at the games coming up on Saturday.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Hey, listener. If you've got a podcast you'd like to nominate for the British Podcast Awards Listener's Choice, then get onto the British Podcast Awards website and vote. Good. Now, later on today in Baku, Denmark are taking on the Czech Republic. And then in Rome, it's England against Ukraine. The last time England played Ukraine, it was September 2013. Up front for England that day was Ricky Lambert, flanked by Theo Walcott and James Milner. England got a draw away from home. Yeah. I mean, they did a job.
I'd take Ricky Lambert now.
Right, okay. England have come on a bit since then. But what of Ukraine? Can their manager, Chevy, give them a lift? Are we right to think that they have about the same chances of the teen cheerleader in the slasher movie or the guy who climbs a ladder at the start of an episode of Casualty? Well, to get a flavour, we rang up Yevhen Muzeika, Ukrainian journalist, in Odessa. Yevhen, everyone here seems to think that this game on Saturday is a done deal for England. What's the feeling there?
Of course, we all understand that England is a clear favorite. You can look at the players from England, that is the players from the teams which compete in a Champions League final. And not all of these players even play in the starting squad. But of course, we would like to believe that we can do it. We can make a sensation like Switzerland did. And we can go to the semi-final. I would say that our chances is not so big, but maybe 20 or 25%.
Well, how surprised are you to find Ukraine in the quarterfinals, just 90 minutes away from your first semi-final appearance ever?
It was like the main aim for our team to go to the last 16. It was quite pessimistic before the Sweden game, but it was a crazy emotions. I was in Odessa in the fan zone near the stadium, and all the people were waiting for the penalties, were a little bit nervous, a lot of emotions in Odessa. And in other Ukrainian cities as well, because a lot of my friends, and it was men, women, all of them, they posted to the Instagram stories. And it was like a holiday for the nation after that victory.
Shever has had to make a lot of changes so far in pretty much every game, and no doubt he will here as well. What's his standing there? Among Ukrainian fans, is his popularity now as a manager approaching that of him as a player?
Most of people loves him, of course, because Ukraine can play very attractive football. Not in all games, but from time to time, it's, I think it's better Ukrainian. It's the best Ukrainian team which I have seen in my life. But of course, there is some people which are unhappy that he is a friend to Andriy Pavelko, the chief of our football association, because, you know, Pavelko is not the most popular here in Ukraine, and Shevchenko is the godfather to his daughter, to Pavelko's daughter. And it's like cool that he gets his job not because of him, of his merits, but because of his friendship. But, you know, hater is going to hate, and Shevchenko showed with his result that he is a good coach. Everybody will go crazy with that, I think, because 6 million people, they watched the games against Sweden. And now I think it will be even more people watching. And of course, when not so big football country, I get a great result. There will be celebrations.
Yevhen Muzeika there. Haters gonna hate, as they say in Ukraine. To recap, Ukraine, who'd lost 1-0 to Austria and who only last October had the worst defeat in their history, getting beaten 7-1 by France, have got half their team out injured. No side has conceded more shots in these Euros than they have. But they will be playing with no pressure. What do you think? Kane hat-trick?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the fans thing is interesting, because obviously it was a great atmosphere beating Germany on Tuesday, but often the fans at Wembley can get pretty ratty if England are kind of, you know, playing a sort of controlled 0-0 against a team that they are thought to be better than. Yeah, I mean, I think Kane, the hope and the expectation is that he scored that one goal. And typically when he ends a drought, he then goes on a tear. This is something I wrote about for The Athletic today, actually. So I think there is a, you know, you would back him to score. I mean, I said this after the Germany game that you can both think that Southgate got it right playing that quite defensive three at the back against Germany, but also think it's not complacent or arrogant to think that that's maybe not the ideal setup for this game. And I do hope he recognises that, you know, England do have, you know, a lot of good attacking options, and they should be front-footed in this game and look to get at a team who had a pretty grueling last 16 match only a few days ago. And, you know, use some of those talents we have. And I think, yeah, if England can do that and get on the front foot, I think they should win this game reasonably comfortably.
I mean, I think that's the positive thing about the Southgate regime, is that in the past, England managers, whether they're successful like Alf Ramsey or Boy Robson in 1990 or not, they tend to sort of stumble upon a system or a team and then just stick with that and go, well, that's going to carry us through.
Totally.
Once it has worked. But Southgate, in every game so far, he has adjusted for the opposition. And I'd be incredibly surprised to see him go with the same system he used against Germany, against Ukraine. I mean, they start deeper they start possessions deeper than any other team left in the competition. They're going to sit back. They also, their four most kind of productive attacking manoeuvres, if you like, all come down their right flank, with sort of Zinchenko dropping in, receiving balls and then pushing it out to Yarmolenko. Now, I think if England played Shaw as a wing-back again, that would leave quite a lot of space for that. So I'd be pretty surprised if we don't go back to a back four, which obviously then allows, you know, Mason Mount to come in or possibly Grealish or even Foden. So... yeah, I think it could. It's one of those games where I think the first 10 minutes is really going to set the tempo. And it's funny with the Stadio Olimpico, isn't it? Because obviously England got so close to playing there in a tournament in 1990, if it wasn't for Pearce and Waddle. And then I guess their most famous game there was the 97 0-0. Mm. And it's not like England to be involved in low-scoring matches. So I wouldn't expect a goal fest unless England did really? Score really early. Yeah, I think it could be cagey for a lot of the game. I think Ukraine are going to sit, and I think England... That's why I would love to see sort of Foden as a false nine, because I think that would really, you know, cause a lot more problems, but that probably won't happen. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to be, you know, to see it 0-0 at half-time and then, you know,
seems like such a dream opportunity to really open up and have some fun, though. Playing for a semi-final against a decimated side who've only barely scraped into the knockout stages. I know, though, that this tournament has underlined the fact that surprises often follow that kind of thinking. So, yeah, probably Gareth's right to continue on the path he's chosen. There have been many suggestions. Do you agree, Charlie, that's what Gareth Southgate's going to do come Saturday evening?
Well, I don't think it's going to be kind of all-out attack, just go out and express yourselves, lads. But I do think that the Germany game is about as conservative team selection as he could feasibly have made. And I don't think he'll do that again. I do think it will be a reversion to the back four. And I suspect we will see an attacking player come in for a more defensive player. So, you know, more like the sort of team that played against Czech Republic, say, in the groups. But it will be controlled, probably, yeah. You know, I think England haven't conceded a goal, and they'll know that if they set up do that again, then they have a huge, huge chance of going through. But I do think they will win probably by a couple of goals, maybe something like 2-0.
If they do manage to keep a clean sheet again, Charlie, they'll be only the second team ever to not concede in their first five games of a major tournament. Who was the first?
England in 66?
No.
No. Is it recent at all? Is it kind of... our lifetime. Do you know the answer, Duncan? Is
sadly, it's, do, yeah.
It's not Spain in 2010 because they conceded in their first game.
Where are England playing on Saturday?
Rome, Italy.
Which tournament, Duncan?
Italia 90.
The Chow powered Italia 90. Yeah, yeah. Which again, you know.
Yeah.
But it's all links back. All links back. But
right.
There's a nice little stat with obviously Man City central defenders so far in this tournament. John Stones hasn't obviously seen a goal go in past his team. Today, after today's game, Emerick Laporte's now on 5 and Ruben Dias ended on 7. So I'm not sure anyone would have predicted those numbers before the tournament started, but here we are.
I like the idea, sorry, just anyone making predictions about that in any case. It would be a very, very niche thing to be in the pub, like, all right, guys, come on, let's get your predictions in.
We'll do City, then we've got to do every club in Europe that's represented.
If England do make it past Ukraine on Saturday night, they will be facing either Denmark or the Czech Republic, which is the other, and for many people, slightly unexpected quarter-final matchup. The Czechs, who for themselves only conceded 2 goals all tournament and who got into the quarter-final by beating Holland and not allowing the Dutch a single shot on target, and they were high-flying the Dutch just before meeting the Czech Republic. Czechs all about getting the ball into Patrick Schick, and it's been pretty effective so far. Denmark, though, who brushed aside Wales with ease, have coming off back-to-back 4-goal games. Very impressive. Who's your money on here, Charlie?
Czech Republic, actually.
Is it? Why?
Yeah, I feel like they're the more solid outfit, and unfortunately, or well, fortunately, depending on your point of view, that's often what wins out in these knockout games. When it, especially when you've got two teams who, you know, probably wouldn't have expected to be there, and are probably suddenly kind of doing that equivalent of looking down from a great height and being like, oh wow, we are actually pretty high up and we have a real chance of progressing. So I think it will be tight, and I think that will play more into the Czechs' hands. So I would back them to squeak through.
Really? Duncan?
Yeah, that doesn't sound massively unlikely. I mean, I think Denmark, they're the, in terms of direct speed and direct play, they're the fastest team left in the tournament. I think, you know, it's one of those weird games. It's a bit like a kind of a Premier League B All-Stars game. We got, you know, Suchek up against Højbjerg.
Like an outside Kufau's the top been... six best of competition,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because, you know, you go back to old tournaments, like, you know, we've been talking about Italia 90, and there'd be games in that where you wouldn't know any of these players. You might know the names or had the stickers in the album, but you didn't really know how they played. But, you know, anyone in England watching Denmark, Czech Republic, it'll be all very familiar. And I think it could be a quite Premier League style match, in fact. I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because if England do get through and say the Czech Republic win, it's always weird when you play a team twice in a tournament.
Right.
Obviously, you know, Portugal in 2004, that did for them against Greece. England obviously lost twice to Belgium in the last World Cup. So it can, that, it's a bit like we said with penalty shootouts
Spain,
earlier.
Russia, Euro 2008.
Yeah, exactly. So if you do something again in a tournament, it can have quite weird psychological effects, I think. So I think I'd rather England, if they were going to get through, would play Denmark than the Czechs again.
It's obviously more complicated now with the teams finishing third and that sort of thing. But I always think teams from the same group should be kept apart until the final. I always found that weird. Like in Euro 2008, it seemed odd that you had teams from the same groups meeting in the semis. Mm. Like I feel like you don't want repeated matches, but as much as you can avoid it.
But they changed that, didn't they? Because I think people said they didn't want it to happen in the final. It was almost like that sport the final. So they then shifted it back to it can happen in the semis. But like you say, with the third place thing, I think it can happen at any point now. So.
Now, yeah. All bets are off.
It's chaos.
Well, whatever they've done with the format, it's been pretty special, the knockout stages of this competition. And let's hope that continues Saturday night with the road teams winning and all that. We shall be back on Sunday morning to review it all. We're not done today, though, because very shortly we're going to be getting some hot takes on some of the big news from outside Euroland. Big managerial appointments, big player signings. Before that, a quick bit of odds from Paddy Power, for which it's over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. I'm on the line with Graham Byrne from Paddy Power. Graham, let's look ahead, please, to tomorrow. And it's Denmark versus Czech Republic to start us off. This one's going to be close, I reckon.
Yeah, definitely. All signs point to this being a close game, two evenly matched teams. But a lot of the public seem to be going towards Denmark. Are they reliving that spirit of, 1992, where they can come in, be the public's team and win? The bet I like here is I like Denmark to win and both teams to score, because the Czech Republic do carry a lot of threat with them. And Schick, of course, he's going to try and join Ronaldo at the top of the golden boot charts. But Denmark have been very impressive lately. They're banging in the goals. They've brushed aside the Russians and the Welsh. I think momentum is on their side. And I will be going with Denmark to win here and both teams to score. That's around about a 4-1 shot.
Okay. Over to Rome then, and it's England versus Ukraine. I've got a bet builder for you, please. Can you price this up? I'm going to go for a 3-0 England win, Harry Kane and Raheem Sterling both to score, and one assist from Jack Grealish.
Yes, well, it's coming in at about 68-1. You're going to get rich if you have a few bob on this one. Correct scores are always difficult to get going with, so a 3-0 correct score will make your bet really juicy. But England haven't conceded any goals. The Ukraines haven't kept any clean sheets, so 3-0 to England looks fair enough to me. Harry Kane, of course, got off the mark. You can't keep a good man down forever. He looks like he's going to kick on from here for the anytime goal scorer. I think it's a fantastic bet. It's nearly about even money, Harry Kane, just to score anytime. That's about 10-11. Raheem Sterling has been the main man for England already. He scored the crucial goals already. Him to score any time is 7-4. And Jack Grealish, he came on, he turned that game around. He is the man who can provide for all of these. Will he start? If he does, he's 5-2 for an any time assist. I think that's a great price for Jack because he's such a creative player. So if we team it all together, England to win 3-0, Kane and Sterling to score at any time, Jack Grealish to assist at any time, it comes to about 68-1. It's a nice juicy bet.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Find a bookie who loves you right back as much as Gareth loves right backs. Place a 4+-fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Listener, it's time to mention the remarkable deal that's currently on offer for subscriptions to The Athletic. A subscription would offer you unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020, all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with writers. And it comes at a price of just £1 a month for your first 6 months. Head to theathletic.com/totally before they come to their senses. All right. Often, at this point in a Totally at the Euro show, we'll do an On This Day in Euros History, today being the 3rd of July. But not much happened, actually. 3rd of July 2016, you got France beating Iceland 5-2. But I'm not sure what particularly colourful memories we've got of that game. I can promise you, though, that Sunday's one is going to be a belter. But let's park On This Day for now and instead just chat about some of the stuff that's happened kind of on this day in 2021, or at least in and around it. You've got Jadon Sancho to Man United. That's now official. Boom. And he'll be fresh. Rafa Benitez is officially Everton's new manager, and Nuno Espirito Santo is Tottenham's new manager. Hey, Charlie. Their last defensively minded, recently fired Portuguese managerial hiring worked out really well for them. But I don't want to kind of come to this from a negative point of view. He did have a transformative effect on Wolves. What do you think about this? Can it work out, especially after that long search for everybody but Nuno?
Yeah, my view on this is basically like it's a fine appointment, and Nuno is a good manager and it may work out. I think there are two things that have really undermined it. One is 2 months ago, you had Daniel Levy talking about, we're only going to appoint someone who plays free-flowing, attacking football and who has Spurs DNA and who gets it and who loves the Tottenham way and who, you know, has a tattoo of Bill Nicholson. And in reality, they've gone with someone who doesn't really embody those things. And so I think supporters are a little bit like, huh, well, why did you say that? Then there's the fact that the manager search was so chaotic and Nuno has been available for quite a lot of that search and wasn't appointed. I think had he got the job the day after he left Wolves, even if you didn't think he was the best appointment, you'd think, well, okay, that's who they wanted. That was the plan. Whereas, you know, given very publicly they've courted many other managers before getting to him, it just doesn't look great. But, you know, hopefully by the time the season starts, all of that will be forgotten. And if he starts well, wins a few games, then, you know, people will move on. And I think the thing as well to say on Nuno is that he's more pragmatic than necessarily kind of defensive and conservative. So he will do what he needs to do to win with the players he has. And at Wolves, you know, they were a team punching above their weight. They finished seventh twice. I know they had a lot of investment, but, you know, and he felt the best way to do that was to play that more counter-attacking style. The hope, what he has said, is that, you know, that won't necessarily be the case at Tottenham. He'll have different players, better players, you know, more exciting attacking players. And we'll set up in a different way. So we'll have to wait and see.
There's a bit of recency bias, isn't there? Because the first couple of seasons in the Premier League with Wolves, they were pretty exciting. Yeah, they were counter-attacking, but I used to look forward to watching them. Yes, last season wasn't good, but they lost Raul Jimenez and it was a real sort of grind to get through to the end of the season. So I think, you know, it was the right time for him to leave Wolves, but I don't think he's a bad appointment. But like you say, the length of time does slightly spoil it.
What about Rafa Benitez to Everton? He's not the first manager to take charge of both Everton and Liverpool. The previous one was quite recently, actually, in 1892, William Edward Barclay.
One normal day of William Edward Barclay, that's all I ask. Will never happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good appointment, though, isn't it?
It is, in the sense that, I mean, I think a lot of people do know this, but Benitez and his family are incredibly settled in the northwest. You know, from his time at Liverpool, I think his family stayed living in the Wirral while he went around the world and Newcastle managing different teams. So in terms of like settling, I think it's a, you know, he'll feel like he's, you know, working from home essentially, as many people have in the last 18 months. But it's one of those appointments where if he starts well, I think it will all the issues will be forgotten. But if he doesn't start well, there's a sizable amount of Everton fans who are not happy with this appointment. And I think it's one of those that, yeah, if they start really badly by sort of September, October, there's going to already be a pretty angry groundswell against him. So no pressure.
All right. In Rafa, we mistrust. What about then a short distance away to the east, the arrival at Old Trafford of Jadon Sancho, who had, as I'm sure we're all aware, an absolutely phenomenal season last time around in the Bundesliga for Dortmund, scoring or assisting 36 goals. He's only just turned 21. A generational talent, is that too much to say, do you think? Or,
well, I think people who watch him regularly would go along with that. I mean, it's interesting because we look at him probably from quite an England-centric view, which is that, you know, he struggles to get in this team, hasn't played as much as a lot of people would like. But for those, you know, more regular Bundesliga viewers, he is sensational. And I think he could be a transformative signing for them. You know, he is someone who should give them a huge amount more threat, different ways of playing. It's just, and it's really exciting, isn't it, just to have those kind of players in the Premier League. It'll be really interesting to see how they play with him as well. And if he gets to looking at the Euros, because that would completely change the complexion of that signing as well, wouldn't it? And there are still a few games to play. Who knows? He could have an impact. Well,
now he's a Manchester United player, he might get in the team. He'll be like, yeah, play for Man United, all right.
But for the tactically dim-witted like me, I would look at this and go, fabulous signing. But that, to me, seemed like an area, and the various areas in which I've seen him play, that Man United are actually pretty well stocked, and that there are other aspects of the team that might require a bit of an upgrade first. But explain to me why I'm wrong.
Well, I don't think that is necessarily wrong. I think he's just an upgrade, like Charlie said. I think he plays a lot more centrally than people think. If anyone's expecting someone that hugs the right touchline, like a classic winger, that's not really, he cuts inside, he's very creative with his passing. Most of his kind of chances created come on the round the D. So he will add a level of guile that I guess you could say United possibly already have with the likes of Bruno Fernandes. But if he can reproduce those numbers that from Germany in the Premier League, I think, like you say, he could be at a level that really does just drag United to, you know, back into title contenders. I mean, just to put it into context, of all players born in 2000 or later, you take all goals in the big five leagues scored by players born in 2000 and later, or assists, Sancho's responsible for 9% of them. There's about 176 players. So, wow. I mean, the numbers he's recorded at the age he is extraordinary. You know, he's up there on, you know, with people like Messi in the last couple of years. So it's just whether he can replicate that. You know, I don't want to be one of those people that's like, well, he's got to do it in our league now because he used to be over here anyway. But it will be interesting. You know, sometimes transfers from other leagues aren't as seamless as people hope they are. So wait and see.
Many question marks, but a huge boost to Man United supporters then ahead of the new campaign. And the first perhaps of... who knows? Could be more big signings there in Manchester. Very nice. Anything else we should be discussing, or should we wrap it up there for today's Totally at the Euros? Charlie?
No, I think so.
No.
I think that's it from me.
Duncan, peace out.
Peace out.
Nice one. All right. Well, Sunday morning, we'll be back with you, listener. Thank you ever so much for being with us today. And I do hope you enjoy this evening's football. Producer Charlie, many thanks for putting this together overnight. We'll be back, as I mentioned, Sunday morning. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at the Totally Show on Twitter and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.